ॐ पार्थाय प्रतिभूतितां भगवता नारायणेन स्वयं व्यासेन कृषितां पुराणमुनिना मध्ये महाभारतम् अद्वैतामृतवर्षिणीं भगवतीं अष्टादशाध्यायिनीम् अम्ब त्वामनुसन्धदामि भगवद्गीते भगवद्वैषिणी.
So we're chapter 9, verse 18. Katir Bharata Prabhu Sakshi. Katir Bharata Prabhu Sakshi. Nivasa Sharanam Surit. Nivasa Sharanam Surit. Prabhava Pralayastanam. Prabhava Pralayastanam. Nidhanam Bijam Avyayam. Nidhanam Bijam Avyayam. Katihi Bharta Prabhu Sakshi Nivasaha Sharanam Suhrit Prabhavaha Pralayaha Stanam Nidhanam Bijam Avyayam. So this is continuing on this Vishvatomukham, and he says Vishvatomukham. The Jnana Yajna for the Mumukshu, the Yajna, the Yajna, or the Vedic rituals that are being done are Jnana Yajnas, meaning where I see myself as both, see Bhagawan as both the subject and the object. I see myself as both subject and object. I see myself as the truth of the whole. That's the Jnana Yajna. And so here, in the verse 15, where Krishna is saying, you know, it is those others, means the mamukshus, those ones who have that sattvic disposition, have the sattvic disposition, those mamukshus, they worship me by means of the jnana yajna. And through the jnana yajnas, they worship me as ekatvena and prithaktvena. Ekatvena means, from the standpoint of jnanam, I see myself as the whole, as one. I am this whole. This whole is one, is eka. So I see myself as one, as this whole, and I see myself as prithak, separate, free from this also. So it's a satya mitya. The ekatva is the mitya. I recognize that all of this mitya is nothing but me. This whole entire creation is nothing but me. And at the same time, I am free of the entire creation. So the being free of the entire creation is the prithak. I see that viveka, you know, the viveka, that seer-seeing differentiation where I recognize that my being is changeless. But then I also recognize that my being is the very self, is the very being of all that is. So this is the satya mitya. It's like the clay pot, where the pot is mitya. There is no pot. There's a pot, but there is no pot. There's no pot that enjoys a separate, independent reality from the clay. So like that, there's nothing in this creation of names and forms, this infinite manifestation, this infinite creation. There's nothing in this creation within all of duality that has an independent existence, an independent being, separate from me. And therefore, I am this. Just like the clay can say, I am the pot can also say, the pot can say, I am the clay. This universe can say, I am the self. That's the I am the whole, because there's nothing here but the self. But then you have to be, the self has to be able to say, if we were to talk, is I am free of the mitya also. It's like the clay is free of the pot, not dependent on the pot. The pot totally dependent upon the clay. It's a different relationship. That's the satya mitya. This creation depends on me, and I am free of it. It depends on me, I don't depend on it. This is the jnana. This is really the truth of the whole thing. And so this being the truth, then I have many faces. Right? I am this, and I am this, and I am this, and I am this. So Bahudha means in many, many different ways I can be worshipped. Right? I'm Vishvatomukham. I have countless faces. Like, there isn't anything that I can't be worshipped as Bhagawan, because everything is Bhagawan. every nama rupa. That's why in the Bhagavad Gita, another verse somewhere in here, you know, Krishna says, you know, in whatever form you worship me, in that form I'll receive you. That's a beautiful thing, because, you know, there's nothing separate from me. That's the truth of it. But at the same time, I am free of all of this. So the creation comes from me, is sustained by me, resolves into me, I remain the same. And so having said this, verse 15, then he goes on in 16, 17, and now 18, where we are now, in giving some examples of myself being worshipped in many different ways. So in this verse, he's giving another list. So he says, you know, the aham is understood here. These are all in the nominatives, just a list of nominatives. Where was the last aham? Clear back in verse 16.
Mm-hmm.
And then from verse 16 on, it starts, you know, he's going verse after verse, I'm all of these things. So now it's aham gatihi. I am the gati. Gati means gum, the root gum means to go, right? Gati means that which is reached. So I am anything that is reached. And even Brahman can be the gati in terms of jnanam, in terms of knowledge. You know, for the mumukshu, I am reached in terms of knowledge. But when we talk gati in terms of going, I am the gati means I am the fruit of any karmapala. Any karmapala, I am what is reached. So I also talk about the gati in terms of, say, for a of a karmata, somebody who's doing rituals and living a Vedic life, they will do rituals, do particular tapas, do prayers, in order to reach the gati like Brahmaloka, to reach a heaven world. And so I am that gati also. All of the different lokas that the jiva transmigrates to, that you land upon because of your punya and papa, I am all of those gatis. Let alone just in this vyavahara, in this realm of reality, anything that I reach, anything that I attain is called a gati. Okay? It comes from the root gum, to go. So my destination. So here it says, I am the gati, I am what is reached. So you can take it in the broadest sense, I am the fruit of any karmapala, the fruit of any action. Okay? So I am the gati, and I am the bharata. Bharata means here, the one who nourishes. And here the nourishment is in the form of sat. I give being. I give existence to all things. So I am the bharata in bhartra. I am the bharata. Bharata also can mean husband, but in this case it's meaning, it's not the right context for that. So in this case, the bharata is meaning the one who sustains, the one who holds, the one who provides the nourishment is the bharata. And I am the prabhu. So bharata nyai from bharata means the sat, the one that gives being to everything. I am also the prabhu. Prabhu can mean, Swamiji takes it like this, I am the master of everything who has all wealth. So he contrasts it to, say, in this loka, in this realm of reality, there are different people who have tremendous wealth and tremendous power. They have tremendous glories and vibhutis and things. They're wealthy, the wealthy. But in the end, these things that these people have don't belong to them. None of these things, none of these things belong to them. They all belong to me as Ishwara. So in fact, the only one that is wealthy here is me, because in fact, I'm the only person that's here. And so this whole manifest creation, which is a manifestation of infinite knowledge. So you have to think of this creation really as an infinite mind. And we say, because manifest knowledge, infinite manifest knowledge. And so I use the example as if I ask you to imagine a universe, you imagine your own universe, and that universe is a manifestation of your universe knowledge. Right? So say if the entire Maya Upadhi, all knowledge in the Maya Upadhi, which is responsible for the manifestation of this whole creation, that Maya, the manifestation of that knowledge, of that Maya, is the manifestation of infinite knowledge. And so you have what we call alpajnaha. You have limited knowledge. However, you can still appreciate the relationship between the conscious being that you are and the manifestation of any knowledge. Like, say if I ask you to think of an oak tree, and then a pine tree, and then an ocean scene, and then a forest. Just go on and on. As I say these words, as long as the words have meaning for you, they will manifest, the vision of them will manifest. That is manifest knowledge. When the vision of it manifests, right, then that thing, whatever manifests through the Maya, is known. Okay? So now imagine the conscious being with this Maya capacity, the total Maya capacity, manifesting, the Maya capacity manifests. That is the creation. And who are we? We are beings within that creation. Like if I ask you to, you know, have manifest knowledge of a meadow with people walking through it, your own animals running around in it, then you are the lord of that manifest knowledge. That manifest knowledge is something that reflects consciousness. The manifest knowledge is known. And all of the creatures in the manifestation, they are also known. But as jivas, they have this capacity to reflect knowledge also. And but the knowledge they reflect, the consciousness they reflect, is what we call upajna. It's limited, right? Because they have a limited mind, limited sense organs, limited body. But because they have a subtle body, which is sattva, it reflects consciousness. And so each one of those little people in your manifest meadow will say, I am Tom, and I am Mary, and I am Jane, and, you know, I am Tibby, and I am everything, you know. Each one will have their name and consider themselves as a unique individual entity. From one standpoint, that's true. Within the creation, each one of us is a unique individual entity. From the standpoint of the body, the mind, the sense organs, even the ahankara, the I notion, all of our thoughts, moods, emotions, all of our history, all of that, each one is different from the other. But from the standpoint of you, who you actually are, the conscious being that you are the self from whom the whole meadow has come. You are the self from whom the whole creation has come. That is the knowledge. So here, Krishna goes, you know, I am the gati, I am every goal, I am the content of every karmapala, you know. I am the bharata, I am the very being, the existence that this whole creation enjoys. But I am, so then he says, and I am the prabhu, I am the existence, but I am also all of this manifestation. I am the total wealth. The wealth that you have and you have and you have and you have and you have all put together, I am all of that. None of it is yours, in fact. Everything is mine. Everything is mine, why? Not because I'm possessive of things, but because I am the self of the whole. In fact, I am you, right? I am you, and you, and you, and you. So there's nothing here that is not me or mine. That's the ideal. But then he says, but I am all of this, but I am also the Sakshi. I am this, but I am the Sakshi. And as the Sakshi means, I am differentiated from all of this. Right? The Sakshi means the witness. Means the witness is the one, to really understand witness, the witness is the one who can be differentiated from the witnessed. Right? If I say I'm the witness, then I'm able to differentiate myself from what I'm witnessing. Okay? And as the witness, I am free. Right? And as the witness, I remain unstained. Now, when you think about it just in terms of this room, you are the witness of everything that's going on in this room that's being perceived through your sense perception. So you're the witness of the activities of the room. You know, whatever your sense perception, what your sense organs fall upon, you are the witness. But then you're also the witness of the sense organs. Right? Because they're also, you can differentiate yourself. You're also the witness of the thoughts and moods and emotions of the mind. Because you can differentiate yourself from them, you're aware of them, you watch them change, you can describe them. I could ask you, what are you thinking right now? And you say, well, I was thinking about this, this, and this. Well, I was thinking about this, this, and this. That means you have a subject-object relationship with that. You are ultimately the witness. then you can say even with the Ahankara, I'm the witness. There's a subject-object relationship. Now, all of those things that at some point in this subject-object relationship, this viveka, that we call this drikdrisha viveka, every single one of these things that you say initially as a witness also transforms into the witnessed from a different standpoint. Like if I say, through my sense organs, I'm the witness of this room. If I got rid of the sense organs, I couldn't witness the room. And so the sense organs, because of the sense organs, I witness the room, right? But the sense organs are also witnessed by the mind. Right? And so they're not ultimately the witness. Ultimately, they're demoted into instruments that I use, or instruments that are used by the mind. So this idea of sakshi moves in one, right? The sakshi, the witness, the mind, uses the sense organs to objectify these objects. So the sakshitvam, the witness, goes to the mind using these instruments in order to see these things. But then we notice that the mind now is the sakshi, is initially the sakshi, but then it also becomes the witnessed. The sakshi mind becomes the witness, witness mind becomes the witnessed, right? Because I'm aware of the mind. I can describe the thoughts and moods and emotions. And so in the end, it really isn't the sakshi. It's also an instrument, because it itself is objectifiable. It itself is witnessed. Now, if I say, I, the Atma, the conscious being, is ultimately, I am ultimately the sakshi, it means there's not another sakshi behind me. Right? There's not a sakshi of the sakshi. If there's a sakshi of the sakshi, that sakshi was only an apparent sakshi, because ultimately that sakshi is just an instrument. It's something that's witnessed. So here, Ishvara says, you know, in terms of this entire creation, okay, in terms of this entire creation, I am the sakshi. I am the conscious being because of whom this entire creation is known. That's how to understand it. Because there's a little shift here in terms when we say sakshi. Because when we say sakshi, witness, we think of the act of witnessing. That's how we think of sakshi. That's why when we do this drikdrisha, the seer-seeing differentiation, in the end, the sakshi resolves into just pure consciousness. So how to understand what Krishna says here, I am the sakshi, it means that in reference to this infinite creation, I am the sakshi, I am the one because of whom this creation is known, therefore I am the sakshi. But because this creation comes into manifestation, is sustained, as we'll see in the next verse, I guess, comes into manifestation, is sustained, and it resolves, when the creation is not present, you know, the creation is not present, it's in unmanifest condition, what is the sakshi sakshiin? You see what I mean? There is no activity for the sakshi. The sakshi is pure consciousness. It's pure chit. It's sat chit. But in reference to the creation, because the creation is known, when I differentiate that which is known from consciousness itself, then consciousness is referred to as the sakshi. And that sakshitvam, that witnessing state, is only from the standpoint of the creation, not from the standpoint of awareness itself. Because awareness is not performing a function of witnessing or looking. It's like the sun is not a sakshi, right? The sun is not performing an act of illumining the earth. Because the sun is luminous, the earth is illumined. See what I mean? So we can say, oh, the sun is lighting us up. The sun isn't lighting us up. The sun is luminosity, right? And because of the luminosity, the earth is lit up. Well, because of consciousness, this creation is known, right? And so from the standpoint of the knownness of the creation, Krishna says, I'm called the sakshi. I'm called the witness. Then he says, and I'm also the Nivasa. I am the home. Nivasa means like a home. I am the home in which all things live. Right? So by that, what's meant is that in the manifestation of this creation, the manifestation of this creation contains all that is. There's nothing outside of it. You know, like Swamiji will say, like, all right, in here, here we are in this home. But this home is contained, this home is contained in Berkeley. So it lives, this home lives in Berkeley. And Berkeley lives in, is contained in California. And on and on and on till California is contained in the states, and the states are contained in the earth, and the earth is contained in this particular galaxy, on and on and on and on. So everything that exists within duality is contained by me. I am its home. There is no home outside of me. That's the Nivasa. And then Nivasa, the next one, is Sharanam. Sharanam is that which gives ultimate protection. Now, within duality, the Sharanam, when we're talking about Sharanam, it would be something like Swargaloka or Brahmaloka, where when the jiva, you know, with great punya, goes into Brahmaloka, then that jiva is totally protected during that time, you know, until the end of the kalpa. So that jiva is protected and taken care of. So it's a relative Sharanam. That's a big Sharanam within relativity. You know, you also, sometimes they talk about Sharanam as when you go to your teacher, you seek refuge in your teacher. And the reason you seek refuge in your teacher, I mean, your teacher is just another human being like you are, but your teacher is also Brahman. Your teacher is a human being, but you're like you are, but the only difference between you and your teacher until you yourself know is that your teacher knows who you really are, you know, and can give you that Sharanam, the ultimate Sharanam, means that ultimate protection. So here Krishna says, I am the Sharanam. I am the ultimate protection. You know, I am the ultimate protection in the sense I am the ultimate refuge. You know, I am the refuge which won't disappoint you in the end. I'm the refuge that, you know, won't betray you in the end. So, in fact, another thing is a little bit tangential to this, but people will sometimes ask, isn't, you know, being a mumukshu, having a desire for liberation, is a desire, after all. And, you know, desire itself is the seed for, you know, for great suffering. You know, and it is. And even the desire for liberation can cause a lot of angst and anxiety and, you know. I remember once when I was with Swamiji the first time in India and I had my visa run out and I couldn't get an extension. It was a nightmare. Couldn't get an extension. And I had to come back, you know, to the States. And then I was going to go right back, stay, you know, a few months. You had to stay here and to make some money and go back. And then something happened with my visa. It didn't work out like it was supposed to. And I remember, and I remember the terrible anxiety that I suffered, that I wasn't going to be able to get back, and I was missing some months of the course, and I was just in so much pain, so much angst, because the desire was so strong. So this desire for liberation can cause a lot of problems. You know, things don't go right, and this and that goes wrong, and, you know, you're then worried, you know, will Swamiji live long enough to teach me everything I need to know? And it goes on and on, you know, all the angst. But the thing is, with this one desire resolves in, you know, desirelessness. Its gati, you know, is free from change. The gati, what is reached by, you know, what this desire resolves into is actually free, where is your freedom. Whereas there is nothing in the creation like that. In the creation, within time and space, every achievement, every gain is what the Buddhists will call, and we might as well call too, we probably call it this too, but I've heard it first through Buddhism, Everything is every sukha, every accomplishment, everything that we gain is really a dukkha yoni. Dukkha yoni means it is a womb for suffering, because every attainment, everything that you have, every wonderful thing that you have, is subject to change and subject to loss, just by the very nature of the creation. There's not a thing you can do about that, in fact. You know, and so, you know, pending doom. one bhasha in the Hastamalika bhasha talks about in their first verse, you know, all of these things are just pending doom. All these sukhas are pending doom for you. Because they won't give anything, they can't, they're incapable of giving anything lasting. And so to whatever degree you are clinging, the problem is one of really clinging, to whatever degree you're clinging to it, to that degree you'll suffer, you know. My favorite example that has actually helped me through my worst moments of clinging is the example of the monkey, you know. The monkey that goes on to a porch of a householder. And on these porches are all of these big pots with little tiny necks like that. They're great big pots, little tiny necks. These big pots are filled with nuts, you know. And so the nuts are stored like that in these big pots with these little tiny necks. And they have these little necks because monkeys will go up to the pots and stick their hand in to grab the jewels of these nuts, and then try to, once they get a nice big handful, well, then try to pull, you know, their hand out of the little neck. And they can't. And they really want those nuts. And they will try to get their hand out and at the same time be able to hold on to the nuts. Even to the point that when the householder comes out with a stick, you know, to beat the monkey, to make the monkey leave, the monkey refuses and refuses to let go of the nuts until it has taken the maximum punishment that it can possibly take, until it finally gives up, and lets go of the nuts, and runs off. That's our situation. That's it to me. I mean, it's such a beautiful example. We will hang on to the things that we think will really make us happy. We all have a few of them, you know, over your life. You have a few really big ones. And, you know, those you hang on to until you're just beaten to a pulp. And finally, you let go. I've had this experience, so I really know what I'm talking about. That's why I like the example. Finally, you let go, and then you think, God, it took so many years. And it's such a relief. It is such a huge relief to have let go, but there was no way that I could let go until I let go. There was no way. And I even knew the monkey story. You know? I knew the monkey. I had this problem for years. You know, certain things that were very important to me. Nope, even knowing the monkey story, my favorite story, I still couldn't let go. And probably, I can think of at least one major event like that, and probably a couple of others that are not so significant, but the tremendous relief, vairagya, you know, this kind of, the real meaning of dispassion, where it's fine, real meaning of dispassion, is it's fine for this to be here, and it's fine for it to go. That's vairagya. This isn't vairagya, where, you know, where you think something should can't be there. If it's there, then that's a real problem. That's not vairagya. That's just another form of clinging. I'm clinging to the way something should be. And if it's not going to be like that, you know, that's as much clinging as the other. And it's all stressful. It's all dukkha. It's all so much sorrow involved in it. You know, and somehow the universe, you know, just peels your fingers one by one, you know, until finally, you know, one by one you're free of these things that you're holding on to. And it's such an incredible, incredible release and relief. So here, moksha, liberation, which with the mumukshu tuan, mumukshu means the desire for liberation. There's a desire there. That desire can cause a lot of angst, but at least the fulfillment of that desire gives you a freedom that is real. And so we say that is the one shudden, that is the one benign desire. All of the other desires are a problem until you're released from the desire. That's what frees you from the sorrow of a desire is the release from the desire. Because actually, if you think about it, for all other desires, the instant the desire arises, you're in trouble. The very instant it raises its head, because it causes stress. The instant it raises its head, that object is away from you. Then there are the people and situations that will support you to fulfill that desire. And then there's the people and situations that are inimical to your fulfillment of that desire. And the world just divides up, you know. And you have to suffer. You suffer until you finally get the object. You have a moment of peace. A moment of peace. And then comes usually some form of worry. Some form of worry like, now I have this, how am I going to keep it? That's one. You know, how am I going to keep it? How can I make it last? And so you just get a moment of joy. For a moment, you're desireless, and then all of the worry starts coming. And then as time goes on, other strange things happen around the object. Like one great one is, I wanted this object so badly, and now I have it, and now I really don't want it. Now it's an obstruction to what I want to do next. It's very odd, this whole thing of desire. So, there is no shadanam. There is no shadanam in the fulfillment of desire, other than the fulfillment of the desire for liberation. There's no safety in it, because there's nothing stable in it. So Krishna says, I am the shadanam, speaking as Ishwara. And he says, I am Sukhrit. Now, Sukhrit's an interesting word. The word mitra, it's actually a neuter word. Mitra means friend, you know. A person who's really a friend to you, a good friend, is a person that cares about you and will help you in times of need and cares. And the reason they care is because they're your friend. They care because you're your friend. A Sukhrit is a person who cares. They need not be your friend. They care and they want to help, but not because they're your friend, but just because they care and they want to help. They don't have a reason for it. That's the Sukhrit. Nor do they expect anything back. A lot of times we will do, I'll do a favor for you because then you'll do a favor for me. That's kind of a tit for tat. I do this and then you do that for me. That type of thing. You know, or I'm helping you because I care about you and you're my friend. Sukhrit is not that. Sukhrit is a person who cares and helps just because that's their nature, not because they need to get something from you or that you're a special friend. And so Krishna says, I'm Sukhrit. I'm the one who cares and will help. Not that I expect something back from you, or not that even you are at this time enjoying some special position. You're not. It's not about having a special position or a special relationship. It's about, you know, whoever you are, you're a special position. Whoever you are, I will help. So that's a beautiful thing. Ajnani, somebody who is mature in their knowledge, you know, is a Sukhrit. I think, and I've always noticed that about Swamiji. He's a role model for me in that. I've always seen him as that. Somebody that, he helps, he wants to help, it's natural for him to help, and he doesn't think anything about it. He helps. It's not because you're his friend, or that because you can give something, it's just natural for him to help. And I've seen over and over and over, you know, through the years, and something that, it's just, sometimes your teacher, if you're lucky, if your teacher is really mature, like somebody like Swamiji, then all of the gunas and the qualities that they talk about in the Bhagavad Gita, in the Upanishads, you know, they talk about all of these qualities, and then you see those qualities, they're living, he's become a dear teacher, can be, not all teachers are to that degree of maturity, but a teacher who is mature like that is really an exemplar of all of these qualities. I remember Swamiji used to be teaching, went through the whole Gita, and you know, there's sections where all of the, they just list out the qualities, and I would say, oh, that is how Swamiji is. I used to think that, you know, and this is after years. He's been able to maintain this for many years, so he's not faking it. No? My mother used to tell me, she used to say, and she was talking about the minimum, don't marry anyone until you've known them for at least 1 year, preferably two. She said, because within that 1 year, you'll see everything you need to see. You know, they can fake it, or just, you know, be in the bliss bubble or something for 1 month or 2 months or 3 months or 4 months. It's really hard to do that for a whole year. You can throw in just one more year for safety. And then she said, when I married your father, I knew what I was getting into. And he was kind of difficult. He was a difficult man. But what she was telling me, I knew he was difficult. And I loved him and I married him and I accepted those difficulties. But I knew about them. Mm-hmm. So you have to know what you're getting into. So that's just in reference to Swamiji. I've known him for many, 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 many years, and I still think he's a great man. Very good man. So, anyway. Now it goes on. Prabhavaha, Pralayaha, and Stanam. I am the one from whom everything is born. This whole manifest creation comes from me. I give birth to the whole thing. The whole thing is born from me. And Pralayaha, I am the one into whom the whole creation resolves. It is born from me, and it resolves into me. It resolves into me. And then I'm also the Stanam. Stanam means the sthiti. You know, sthiti means the place in which it abides. So we say the creation it's created, it manifests, it is sustained. So the sustenance, sustaining, is the Stanam. It is sustained and it resolves. So it projects, is sustained, and resolves. I am the one from whom it projects, I am the one who sustains it, and I am the one into whom it resolves. So I am the Stanam is often called Stiti, right? And then the Pralaya is called Laya. So I'm the creation, the Stiti, the Srishti. Stiti, if you've heard the Srishti, Stiti, Laya. I'm the one from whom the creation, you know, expresses, sustains it, and into whom it resolves. Because, you know, it's so, you need to understand something about Maya. Because Maya, the Maya is what projects, is sustained and resolves. So, what is the relationship between Maya and that one who sustains the Maya? Who is the self of the Maya? Who is the truth of the Maya? Does Maya have any being of its own? That's what has to be understood. Clay pot is perfect to understand this. If you think of pot, is there a pot apart from clay? Does it have any being? Does it even exist? See, the thing is, in reference to the clay, the thing is, the pot is there. It is useful. It has a function. We call it pot. We don't say, oh, look at the clay. We say, look at the pot. I said, there's a pot there. But is there a pot there apart from the clay? We'd say, no. There's really only clay there. So here it's the same. This is the relationship with the creation. This Maya that comes from me, is sustained by me, resolves into me, has no independent being whatsoever for there even to be any Maya, except the Maya is there. That's why Swamiji gives this etymology for Maya. Ya, ma, iti Maya, that which is not. Ya means that which is. Ma, ya means that which is. Ma means not. That which is not, iti, puts it in quotes, sa Maya, that is Maya. Means here it is, but there is nothing here independent of being itself. The same way you can talk about the relationship between the clay and the pot, you have to be able to talk about the self and this creation to really understand Maya. Now, even when you think of, you can use the dream analogy also, the dream or the imaginative function, to be. But what you have to look for, say if I, it's a little different, it's not as concrete as when you think of clay pot, but it's the same. If you imagine something, your imagination is three-dimensional. It has color, it has form. From within it, if there's a jiva, an individual within the imagination, it looks around through its own sense organs, and it's totally, immersed. It immersed in the imagination and can, from its own standpoint, only experience what is within the imagination. Right? A being within the imagination, your imagination, can only experience what is within the imagination. Whereas for you, the whole imagination is nothing but you. You see that? Like if I ask you to imagine the meadow, the imagination itself has no substance, it has no being, it has no consciousness, it has no knownness, it has no substance at all apart from you. And so when you have imagination, now, you have to kind of slow down your mind to appreciate this, but when you have an imagination, now, imagination really stands for any thought. Now, before the imagination, there is knowledge, knownness, just by the very nature of consciousness. So I could even say like this, if I got rid of the whole universe, all duality, get rid of the whole universe, and all that there is the consciousness, which is you, nothing else, just the consciousness that is your being. That consciousness is known, not as an object, but by its very swarupa, by its very nature. Consciousness is not inert. It is not unknown. It is self-shining. So your being is self-shining. It is known, okay? Because it's self-shining, self-evident. So now for self-shining, self-evident, what I'm going to say, I'm going to use another word. I'm going to say this, self-shining, self-evident consciousness, it is known. That's what I mean when I say self-evident. It is known. It's self-shining. So can I say the word is known? Do you understand what I mean? It's really important here. Because the other thing won't work if you don't understand what I mean. Okay. So the consciousness itself is known because it's self-evident. Now, if I have an imagination, like the meadow, now all of a sudden, the meadow is known. Right? The meadow shines. The meadow is self-evident. Only from the standpoint of the is known. I won't use the word self-evident for the... Let me not use the word self-evident for the meadow. The knownness of awareness of your being, right? Now, think of it like the clay, okay? The awareness of your being like the clay. Now there is the Maya meadow. Now the Maya meadow, which has no being of its own, is known. But the only is known that is there is consciousness. Now you think, you superimpose the self-evident nature of consciousness onto the Maya meadow. And it's like the meadow is being known. But the meadow isn't being known
there's only one knownness, and that is consciousness. So here in this, I know this is a little hard, but you have to meditate on it. It's a worthy meditation, a guided meditation. Okay, but now let me explain. Here we have this room that you're experiencing through your sense organs. This is just all, really all that you're experiencing here is a thought modification, right? Because your eyes and your sense organs give you a thought, a vritti of the room. Otherwise, if you're, let me put it this way, if your sense organs are open, you know, they're all here functioning well, and you're daydreaming, what you know is the daydream. You don't know the room. Right? Whatever is happening in your mind, that is what you know. So even though, even while I'm talking, some of you may not be hearing one word I'm saying because you're daydreaming. And then you'll, you know, Swamiji makes a lot of fun of that. You click back to, what was she saying? Did I miss something? You know? So what you know is the vritti, the thought modification in your mind. Okay? Okay, so now in reference to this room, you have a thought modification, a thought. Let's just call it a thought, a knowledge thought. And that knowledge thought is known. So whether it's the knowledge thought of the room, or it's a meadow, or it's a dream, or it's an emotion, doesn't make any difference. It's just the thought, whatever it is. Yeah. This thought, we say, it is, because it is, right? And it is known, right? But really, nothing is or is known except for consciousness. And in fact, this has no reality, no being at all other than consciousness, just like the pot has no being at all other than the clay. Nothing at all. But it's there. That's why we call Maya. We don't say this doesn't exist. We say it is here, but we call it Maya because it has no independent being whatsoever, not any more than a clay pot in reference to the clay. And so now the thing is, we say all of this is and is known, you know, and that gives us its substance, its reality. But what is and what is known is Brahman. And that never changes. That is why when you wake up from a dream, nothing happens. When you wake up from a dream, this is just going back to you as an individual, you have a dream at night, you wake up, there's a, say it's a very real dream and all kinds of stuff is going on, it's very important and all this kind of stuff. You wake up from the dream and that Maya disappears, but nothing has happened. Because nothing has happened. Because what is actually there hasn't changed or moved in the slightest degree. Because the Maya has no independent substance to affect in any way what actually is. Now, this is why also, for a person who dies, say you lose this body, the prarabdha is over, whatever, you lose this body, what your experience will be that the scenery changes, but nothing happens to you, zero. Nothing happens to being, nothing happens to existence, nothing has happened. But say, for instance, like if you walk from this house to Andronikos, when you get to a, you know, as soon as you go out the door, the scenery is different. But nothing has happened to you. So when this body drop it, and we don't even worry about that. We don't think about that. It's a non-issue. You can even say, you know, the thought that I just had is totally gone, but I'm still here, so everything's fine. The experience I had in the last minute is totally gone. It doesn't, and no part of it even exists right now. Because it's gone. It's gone. But I'm here. So that is inconsequential to me. That everything of the last moment is gone is inconsequential to me because nothing has really happened. Because nothing has happened to the being which is myself. Now the death experience will be exactly like that because there is no such thing. Nothing happens. The scenery might happen, or change, of course, the scenery changes, But it all changes within the same set, within the same creation, which is one. One creation with one set of laws that goes through many lokas. You know, and how many times, even in terms you might feel shocked, like, oh my gosh, I'm still here, nothing has happened. You can have thoughts like that. You probably won't, though. You know why? Because the number of births that you have had are beginningless. So how many deaths have you had? Beginningless. And so it's a well-known experience. It's a well-known experience, but when you take the physical body, you don't remember it. But you've had, you know, countless. Anyway, am I getting off the track? Not for me. I am, but I'm not off the track for myself, but I might have lost you guys by this point. But,
no, just go on.
So, but this is a big thing, you know. It's at least with these words, maybe if your mind's following me at all, you can start to notice the reality of it. The reality of it is that the being that is here is the constant, and the conscious being that is here is the constant. Nothing is ever away from it. No experience ever is away from it. You, nor do you ever change in any way. This needs to be discerned. It's a reality, but it needs to be discerned because the mind is only used to being captured, you know, by the objects that you're in a subject-object relationship, you know, in terms of the body, mind, sense organs, engaging with the objects that you see. You don't recognize that the body, mind, sense organs themselves are part of the creation, part of this picture, and the whole thing is taking place in a silent, changeless you. That's what needs to be discerned. That's why one of the major prakriyas, teaching methodologies, the initial one that is so often used, we can do it other ways, but is often used, is the seer-seen differentiation. You know, so that I can give to the creation all of the things that can be objectified, all of the things that I can witness. Whatever is possible to be witnessed, to be objectified, leaving me alone as the sakshi, that cannot become a object of the sakshi, I need to do all of that first in order to release my being from these things that are objectified so the body, mind, sense organs can be given back to the creation. Once I do that, I recognize this whole creation exists in me. Once I give all of the things that I, the conscious being, have been identified with back to the creation, then there's nothing limiting me. The whole creation exists in me. I am the being, you know, which is the Nivasa. As Krishna says, I'm the Nivasa. I'm the home for the whole thing. I am the Bartha. I am the very being which this whole thing enjoys. And I am the one from whom it comes, sustained, goes back, all of this. So he's just going through the whole vision of himself, really. And then now he says, Nidanam. I am the Nidanam. Nidanam means I am the Satyam. I am the one who sustains all of this without myself undergoing any change. It's like being the anvil. You know, sometimes we use the term kutesta, where the Brahman is looked upon as an anvil, where things are beat upon it and its things change upon it, but it itself doesn't go through any type of modification. So like that, I am the very satyam of this whole creation, myself not going through any type of modification. And then finally he says, I am the bijam, I am the seed, I am the cause. Bijam literally means seed. I am the cause of this whole thing, but myself is avyayam, changeless. And the cause of the whole thing, there's no other cause. There's no second being. There's no other source. There's no other cause other than me. But I myself am changeless. This is where the maya comes in. Because I don't change or go through any type of modification to become the creation. And yet I'm the bijam, I'm the seed, the cause for the whole creation. So this is, it's quite a verse. Yeah, but he's going, there's more, we're not going to do more today. But there's more where he's going on. This is the Vishvatomukha, he's just talking about the nature.
He's talking about your nature, because you are Ishwara. Not from the standpoint of the body, mind, sense organs, you're part of Ishwara. But from the standpoint of your being, you are Ishwara. So Krishna is talking about, I am this, I am that. But the Mahavakya is the one that I am, is the one that you are. So the Lord says, Krishna says, I am this, I am the one from whom this whole creation has come, and this I that I am is the I that you are. That's the whole, that is the teaching of the Upanishads. So, let's stop here. Let's take a moment. Purnamadah, Purnamidam, Purnat, Purnamadachate, Purnasya, Purnamadaya, Purnamevavasishate, Om Shanti, 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 Hari Om Shri Guru Pyo Namaha, Hari Om.
That you said about the mini death. There was a, I lost you there when you started to talk. What way I've had so many death, and so it's like
I was talking from the standpoint of the jiva. Even from the standpoint of the jiva, the sukshma sharira, the subtle body, is that never experiences any death. But from the standpoint of the body, each body is, you know, is born and lives and dies. And so that's what we talked about, just the death of the physical body. Because the sukshma sharira, the jiva, transmigrating to jiva, there's no death. And of course for the self, there's no death, no change.
Okay, I thought you were going somewhere totally different.
Oh.
And that's happened so many different times, but we've never noticed that, nothing happens to me.
You notice it when you're dying, because you realize you're not.
Yeah.
That's a nice experience.
But
oh, it doesn't happen.
But it's not remembered to make you free, though. I mean,
no, because see, even samsara, it's not the fact that you never die as a samsari. That's not the ultimate freedom, because there's so much suffering in life. So you can think, I'm going to go on endlessly. You know, people. I'm going to go on endlessly, you know, going through the sukha, dukkha, sukha, dukkha, sukha, you know, pleasure, pain, pleasure, pain, pleasure, pain. There's no, then at some point you say, is there any way to get off this wheel of samsara? Is there any way to get off of it? Swamiji uses the example of the drowning man. It's not just his example. I think it's the example, widely used example, of a person in the ocean drowning, you know, where the undertow pulls him down and then pushes him up and then pulls him down. And initially when he's pushed up and he gets some air, he's so happy. You know, thank goodness. But then pulled back down right away again. Then pushed up, thank goodness, thank goodness. But then, you know, how many times are you going to be happy? You know, say, okay, 10 times, 20 times, 100 times, 500 times. 5,000 times. At some point, you're going to say, okay, you know, it's like no clinging again. You don't, this is not helpful. Is there any way to get off of this samsara? Yeah.
And that's been happening to us. That's why we're here. I mean,
finally, we're here. That's why you have to be humble, because, yeah, when you think that the lifetimes are beginningless. Right. And so at this particular time for you as a jiva, that, and we can say through crores, this is in the tradition, crores and crores of punya, you know, your mind has gained a certain shanti, enough shanti
to make you into a mumukshu, to have that self-reflection. If that's not normal, that's why the mumukshu is so praised. It's unusual to be a mumukshu, to be somebody that questions in this way. And there's a lot of reasons for that. The creation takes care of who you are, like you're a teacher, or you're a student, or you're a mother, or you're a father, or you're a sister, or you're happy, or you're sad. You always have a way to identify yourself. I'm this, and I'm that, and I'm this, and I'm that. And every moment defines you, in fact. You know? So the ahankara, always has something to land on. You know? And so there's all this, that you're relatively explained to yourself continually. But at some point, you know, a person starts reflecting, well, what is the purpose of all of this? And who am I really, you know? Who am I essentially? Is there any way to know that this type of questioning starts? You know, and even the recognition of, it takes a lot of discrimination, viveka, to realize that how a desire works. I want this so that I can be happy. I get it, and then immediately I want something else. What is that? Most people don't even realize that. What they'll think is, you really want something, and you work for it, and work for it, and finally you get it, and now you have it. And you do have a moment of real happiness, and, you know, you're so happy to have it. But then you realize that, well, yeah, but I also need this. And that's a little disappointing, but you just think, okay, that's all right. I just need this too. But then you start realizing, this process never stops. There is no final this, nor is there any lasting happiness that's attained from the gain of anything. You start just recognizing the truth of that. And then you start becoming very reflective and wondering, is what does it mean? How is it possible to really be whole, to really succeed, where success would be, you know, where you can say, oh, I made it, I'm a success. What would that mean? That I'm, could I, would I be in a position to say, I am a whole and complete person, no matter what happens in the world? How could that be possible? How could that, where I can say, okay, now all is well with me, and I can stride through the world, you know, as a full, complete person. But I can be whole and complete in spite of the changing sukha and dukkha, pleasurable and painful experiences. How is that possible? You know? Or is it all right just to be an unhappy person? That isn't all right. If it were all right, then you can say, I am happily unhappy, and that is all right. That's all right.
You don't say that.
Yeah, but if you can say, I'm fine with being unhappy, then you're fine, because the unhappiness is objectified, and you're fine with that. It doesn't make any difference. But you wouldn't be fine saying, you know, at the bottom line, I am an unhappy person, and there's no one behind it. You know, the unhappy person is the one who's experiencing this world. It's not that I am experiencing the unhappiness. It's that I, the unhappiness, am experiencing the world. And that isn't okay. It just isn't, you know.
No, what's interesting is what I've been reflecting upon is, it seems like when people who are kind of jnanis, there don't seem to be much, I mean, the personal relationship, like an intimate relationship, like a marriage or so, you know, it seems like there's a natural disengagement from that. Well, I mean, there is like, I don't know too many people who are like two jnanis in a relationship. So the question is, do they not need each other anymore? Because there's no need, there's a natural disengagement. Or Because my question is kind of, if two people have that perspective of being Atman and nothing but Atman, then that's really clear, and they explore that together, let's say, and they find that mutual ground where they can actually communicate about that, and they start to live that, you know? Now, would they, because there's this natural tendency to disengage from the senses and all of that, right? Because there's all the relation to desires changes, everything changes, right? So then there's just beingness with Ijeza. But what's the driving force?
You know what you're forgetting here in this is the Prarabdha Karma. The Prarabdha Karma is what takes you, the main kind of thrust of your life from birth to death, okay? And so whether you're with a partner or whoever, you're still, you know, with human beings, you're still with people, you're still with a situation, whatever it may be. Maybe that situation is, you know, your partner and a bunch of kids. You know, but that doesn't make any difference. It doesn't make any difference. There's dharma involved. And so there's engagement to whatever engagement there is. Just like in the world, there's engagement. But vairagya is not this. It means that I can be with you as you are. You know, and if the prarabdha comes to an end, then it comes to an end. But to think, I don't think it's correct to say that knowledge means that you can't be with somebody. Or that you can. I don't think it's a statement on that, because there's too much prarabdha involved in that. Like there's married rishis and all of that type of thing. There's examples even like Janaka, who was a king. So you're thinking that really to be a jnani, you need to be a sannyasi up in the mountains. I don't accept that. That can be true for you, though. That can be true for your prarabdha. Mm-hmm. But to say that there aren't people who are married who have knowledge, that isn't true. I mean, I personally know that's not true.
Aren't desires also considered to be vibhutis?
You know, the thing is, desires are part of the prarabdha. The difference between a jnani, one who has maturity in their knowledge, and an ajnani is that the full template of the desire, which goes like this, you know, I call it the desire template. I need this in order to be happy. That's not true. You can say, I want this, I would like to have this, or I need this, but if you don't get it, that's fine too. Because your ananda truly is not dependent. And so you can even be engaged in something and really enjoying something, and then it doesn't work out in that way, and then you can, okay, then you let it go. That monkey thing isn't there, you know? Like if the monkey sees the guy coming with a stick, he'll go, oh, okay. Well, let's get out of here. Let's go.
It's time to split.
Time to go. That's all right. I don't really need that. But if no guy's there, maybe I can try a little bit, but, you know? You see what I mean?
Yeah, it's clear.
Yeah. And the other thing is, say...
Well, I was also not believing that the relationship is over. I was just questioning that and I was just exploring that, because I think there are a lot of people who enter on the spiritual path where there is a disconnect, maybe because they're becoming swamis and that's just their life path, and that's a different story maybe, you know?
If it's in the prarabdha, then it's natural to them, then that is fine. That's a lifestyle.
Yeah.
You know, but then to try to... This is the whole... In fact, the whole Gita is about this, in fact. Mm-hmm. You know, that karma yoga and sannyasa are two lifestyles. Mm-hmm. In the end, you know, a person has to become what we call a sattva karma sannyasi, somebody who gives up all karma. Whether you're a sannyasi or a karma yogi, you can't give up all karma. The only one that gives up all karma is the one that never had any karma, and that's Brahman. So when you recognize yourself as being free from karma, all of this is Ishvara, then, you know, whatever relationships are there or lack of relationships are there in your karma, this is what is unfolding for you right now. This is it, you know. Otherwise, you're bringing in a lot of kartritvam, like you're saying. Kartritvam means doership. Like you're saying, oh, this situation, if I were really a jnani, you know, then this situation would not be here, and this situation would be here, and then I would only be, you know, up in Rishikesh, you know, in my kutir.
But Carol, when a jnani sees everything as Ishvara, is there still kind of an as though I?
Absolutely.
There with the body mind.
There is, mm-hmm. But that would be. That's what in Panchadashi they talk about this really beautifully. Mm-hmm. Say for a jnani, you have an I thought. That's it. Where you say, like we're just talking, I'm going to the store. So what if I say to you, because I'm teaching you, I'm supposed to be a jnani. So now I say, so you're all looking at me, oh, she's a jnani. But then I say, I think I'll go to the store. I'm going to go to the store. And then you all go. How could she have said that? You know? Because I should have said, the body. The body, which is not me, is going to go to the store. So what I'm saying, they call this a dugda bija. It's a burnt seed. That ahankara is still there because it's functional. But it doesn't have any meaning. It means when you say, I'm going to the store, it means that, you know, I know that, say if I were, okay, I know that I'm not the body. And I know that I'm really not going to the store. And when I say the word I, that's a shortcut for the body. So that you all don't think I'm weird by saying the body is going to... You see what I mean? There's so much in that statement. So much that in Panchadashi in the chapter 7, he talks about it. You know? Vidyaranya talks about it. Now, who wrote Panchadashi?
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. I was thinking Vedalta. Sorry, I got confused. Yeah. So he says, you know, there's some the I when it's being used with Brahma, as Brahman or the Atma. When do you use it like that? When you're teaching, it's used in teaching. It's not used in table talk, mm-hmm. or in common parlance. You know. You don't use you just use the I as it's being used, or you know, I am happy, or I am sad, or I am thinking, or I have this to do, or I have that to do. You're just using it as an I, an empirical reality, but you know completely what you're doing. How the word is being used. Whereas for an agnani, when they say, an agnani, one who doesn't have knowledge, says, I'm going to the store, what do they mean? This person, this body, mind, sense organs, that's called radha or whatever, is going to the store. There's no other thing that is meant there.
But there must be some sort of, prior to jnana nishtha, some sort of middle ground or something, where you need to, that nidha dhyasana, to sit with the I, that's Brahman. Because the I am going to the store habit of the ego identifying, you know, of the ahankara, still kind of...
I would say like this, once yourself is really... been differentiated and recognized, then the problem is that self is there. You can't really get rid of it once that is recognized. But the mind habitually behaves in a way that is not true to what you know. It gets overwhelmed by emotion or reaction or likes and dislikes and all of this kind of stuff. And that's where that nidha dhyasana is useful, and also where, you know, you kind of have to bring your mind back through your knowledge. And you can't really just go out and grab it and say, come, you know, come back here. But you bring it back through your knowledge. Because that's that kind of habitual self-forgetfulness. You know, I mean, the mind, just think of your mind. And Carl Jung, some of his first... experiments and research was on the nature of the mind and its associative thinking. One thought leads to the next. It's kind of, the mind has a life of its own. And if the buddhi isn't there, to grab it when it's just going off on well-worn tracks. You know, it's going off on well-worn tracks. Then it'll just continue on and you'll find yourself way out there somewhere. And then you have to bring your knowledge to it to rein it back in. And that goes on for some time because it takes a while for your knowledge to work its way through all these well-worn tracks. You know? Because it's like you're re-grooving the mind in a way. Because those tracks don't make any sense anymore. They go totally against what you know and who you are. So slowly but surely, you know, they all get rerouted.
If nothing changes within consciousness, I know this has something to do with karma and the accumulation of karma, but why do we take different forms? Why do we move through different forms?
The one that's moving through different forms is the subtle body. Right, so the subtle body is different than, in a sense, different than, subtle body is still within Maya. Right, and so the consciousness is not moving through different forms. The subtle body is moving, but the subtle body, we can say, reflects consciousness or manifests consciousness. The consciousness itself doesn't change or move.
I guess my question is, why was Maya necessary?
Because, oh, I see. Then you're thinking that Maya is created or has a beginning. And we say it doesn't have a beginning. We say Brahman, consciousness is, we don't even say beginningless. Consciousness is not beginningless. It's timeless. Right? There's no, whereas Maya is something that from beginningless time manifests and goes into unmanifest, it's manifest, it stays. But there's no beginning. Now, if there's no beginning, there's no reason. Like, there's no reason. Oh, it's like Bhagavan said, let's make some Maya. Let's create Maya. That would be interesting. But without the Maya, there's no Bhagavan. I see Brahman, which is timeless, which has naturally to it this Maya, which has no being apart from Brahman, so it's not there as a second thing, right? That is reality. But then we say Advaita, non-duality, it's non-dual because, just like the clay pot is non-dual, there's not clay and a pot. There's only clay and the Maya pot, right? So there's only consciousness and the Maya, which is natural to consciousness, but doesn't make a second because it has no independent being. Do you see what I mean? So the question of cause-effect and why did this happen, you know, why did Bhagavan do it this way and all of that, that kind of thing can only take place within duality.
I have another question about emotions. Like, for example, the emotion sadness or so, right? Now, some of that is prapta karma, right? How much sadness somebody has in their life might be.
No, I would say like this. Situations, I would say for every jiva there's 50-50 of situations.
Right.
That are designed to make you happy or not happy. How you respond to them, in other words, to a jnani, the situation is still not a happy situation.
Right.
But the degree of sadness that you might have as a jnani would be much less, if any.
Yeah, so that's my question, actually. Exactly. So is it just that the emotion of sadness will still be there, but the ripple is not going to be so strong? So because there's a different inner relationship to the sadness itself, because there's not an identification with the sadness?
Well, let's put it like this more. What allows for sadness, anger, all the different kinds of emotions has really to do with what you expect of that situation. Mm-hmm. In other words, I want it to be like this, and it's not. It's like this, and therefore I'm sad. Mm-hmm. But what if I don't demand a situation to be in a particular way? So then it's still an uncomfortable situation or a sad situation, mm-hmm. but there's nobody in me building up on it. Now, say if it's a situation that's organically, like say you lose a partner or you lose someone dear to you, you know, mm-hmm. in that way, then that emotion would be natural for that emotion to come, to rise. But that's what it would do. It would rise and set. It's kind of like riding on water. Because what is different is that there's nobody building up on it. Mm-hmm. So there's two things that I'm saying there. There's going to be much fewer unpleasant things that will actually make you angry or sad, because you're not asking them to make you happy. See what I mean? So you have a different relationship. So in that way, and then there's things that are very humanly. It's natural, very natural to be sad, like the loss of your parents or some loss like that. Then you should have that emotion, but you would also appreciate that emotion and not build up on it. So it's also a different way of relating to the emotion.
Good. So what I notice is that you don't use words like identifying with something. So you don't do that, right? Or do you use that?
What do you
descriptively?
Mean?
Like let's say if I say the charge, I see that the charge around a certain emotion diminishes, because I'm not identifying with the emotion per se as I'm sad. You know, so it's not like if I know I'm Atman, then the identification of I'm sad in this body-mind complex, there's a lot less charge around that. You know, it's more like sadness just happens, and it's just kind of coming and going, but there's not like I am sad, and I shouldn't really be sad because I really would prefer to be happy. You know, that whole kind of thing is not really happening because there's a new reference point. And so I call that not identifying with the sadness. But anyway.
No, that's all right. Okay. You know, I'm really kind of careful sometimes with you know, where some different kind of traditions, like I'm thinking of Gurdjieff and Uspensky, the little tiny bit I know about them, I'm not...
All right.
Okay. Uh-huh. Where they're always trying to watch their thoughts. Like, they're here, and the thought is here. And so, like, even now I'm talking to you, but I'm not really talking to you because... I'm not really engaged with you because I am really focused on watching my mind talking to you. That is weird. And it's not... It is. And there's like this double activity going on.
This distancing technique.
Yeah, distancing.
Instead of objectifying.
Mm-hmm. Instead of... It's not necessary. Mm-hmm. And the fact is that when you're talking and engaging and being with people and you're having emotions and whatever it is, there is the reality of the stability of yourself that is self-shining there amidst all of that. And you don't have to have this type of person come in the middle. You know what I'm saying? And so sometimes when you're talking in that way, it excites that kind of Gurdjieff problem. Now, say you're walking, and when you're walking, you're supposed to be, you know, aware of every movement. These are kind of interesting exercises, but they should just be an exercise and not a way of life.
And the other thing is, if you weren't identifying with your emotions, if you weren't identifying as the Atma, then what would you be identifying as? Do you know what I mean? I mean, as long as you haven't recognized yourself as the Atma, you are identifying with your emotions. I mean, you don't have...
Well, that is true, and that your self is self-evident. So once it's recognized... And that's the ahankara, they call the ahankara, the I, actually rests in yourself. Mm-hmm. You know, and so the yourself is always the point of reference. So whatever you're thinking, whatever emotions you're having, whatever you're doing, the point of reference is yourself, the Atman, not yourself, the body, in terms of when you think of I, of me.
Yeah, not in terms of how are you managing or something. Or how am I managing my sadness? It's not about that. It's like
your mind,
what Danya was saying.
Like, yeah. If you say, yeah, how am I managing my sadness? If you said that to me, then I was thinking, well, you're probably using the various tools that we've taught about how to manage sadness.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But all of that activity is going on in yourself,
mm-hmm,
which is stable and still and just fine.
Right.
Yeah. And that becomes, and that is natural. That's not something that the mind has to work at, because once that ignorance is removed, so you don't need that middle person. So if you were to say, how am I managing my sadness? You're talking about the buddhi, the one who has knowledge, how you're taking care of the mind that maybe has this complex or that complex, or it needs this or needs that, or has this lack of vairagya here that's causing some problems. How do I manage all that? That's all totally legitimate.
That's just part of the inquiry.
It's part of the inquiry. And all the while, once you've gotten to know yourself, who you really, who you are, that you are just there.
Well, then,
and you're always there.
Right, and then there's also there doesn't need to be anything really changed about what is, because that's just what it is.
That's right.
So it's like,
and
what,
it won't ever not
saying,
be.
You know, it's like then you just say it, and you can embrace that through the lens of Atma.
Because the sadness is there, but you're there, and you're fine. You're, you know, so in fact, your being holds that sadness, and it's not a problem.
Mm-hmm.
It is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
We have to stop. Is it okay for us to stop now?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's good.
Good.